Give you some brief overview of fractional quantum Hall effect states. It's a very rich field, and people worked on it for many, many years. And there are a lot of exotic things that come out of it. All I can do in the short time we have is basically survey a few things. And it might feel a bit in the air because there are some things that I'm not going to derive all the way, but I'm going to try to just motivate to show you what kind of physics we get in this problem. But before that, let me just make a couple of comments about things we did yesterday. So one of them is the gauge field, the symmetric gauge, the wave function we had for the symmetric gauge. So we wrote our psi to be some z star to the m, and that was for the lowest lambda level, e to the minus z squared, or 4lb squared. First of all, I want to drop this star. And the reason I can do that is that the sign in front of each and every I that you have in the Hamiltonian, actually not each and every one, before IY that you have, comes from the sign of the magnetic field. So I can just reverse the sign of the magnetic field and I'll just get Z here. So everything else just follows through in the same way. But it goes for the creation and annihilation operators, all of that. But this is just a technical remark. The other remark I wanted to make is actually related to a question that Peter asked me yesterday, which is, in this function, how do we find the degeneracy? And I just realized yesterday that it's a little more more important. It kind of helps you understand things a little bit. So let me just quickly say that. If you look at this function, I can write it as e to the I phi m. And then everything else is just radial. So what I can do is I can actually, so we know this is an eigenfunction of the angular momentum. Now the question is, what is this function? Well, it's a Gaussian multiplied by a polynomial. But you can actually see that it's peaked somewhere. When this m is 0, it's peaked around 0 in the radial direction. So now I'm thinking of a disk geometry, and this is my radius. I'm going to have something that is peaked somewhere along this radius. And this somewhere turns out to be root 2m lb squared. And the way to do that is just to take the derivative, find the maximum of this function, basically. So we can put it in different places. And now to calculate how many m's we have here, we should just notice that this R basically encloses some area which has some flux, which I will call phi m. And this phi m will be pi Rm squared times b, okay? And this is basically pi times 2m lb squared times b. And let me just write it. So it's 2 pi. Lb squared is h bar over e b, and I multiplied by b. And I have m here. So basically, phi m is the flux quantum times m. So my wave function encloses n flux quanta. And this immediately tells me how many flux, what's the maximum m that I can enclose. And that would be all of that area. So either just equate this Rm to the size of the system, or basically just say that m maximum encloses is actually, phi m maximum encloses all of the flux, which means that m is phi over phi naught. And phi over phi naught, just to remind you, is also the degeneracy of the Landau level, which we had before, and another expression for it was the area over 2 pi lb squared. So this is about that function. I think it's also a gauge that is kind of useful when you want to thread flux and do the Laughlin arguments, because when you thread a flux, basically all of n grows by one, and the state just goes from the center where you thread the flux to the edge. And now another comment I would like to make is on the two-body wave function, phi 2 of z1 and z2, which we wrote as z1 minus z2 e to the minus z1 squared plus z2 squared over 4 lb squared. So two things I want to say about this. One is I told you that this is an exact wave function, and we can add any angular momentum, and we can add also, and I'm not going to use it so much, but we can add also total angular momentum for the center of mass coordinates. And basically, I told you that this is an exact wave function for any kind of interaction, as long as the interaction doesn't take us from one Landau level to the next. But we didn't actually show that. We didn't actually show that it is an eigenfunction. So obviously, it is an eigenfunction of the kinetic energy. Now, what does it mean? How do I show that this many-body wave function is an eigenfunction of the Hamiltonian? What do I need to do? But when I act the Hamiltonian on it, so kinetic part works. When I act the V of Z minus Z1 on it, Z1 minus Z2, I just get an extra factor. And it's still dependent on the coordinates, and I don't know if this is the right thing. So what I have to do is actually really act on it, which would be to integrate. And basically what I can do is take two wave functions and sandwich. Now, to say that this is an eigenstate would be to say that if I have here two indices, m and m, and I put here m and m, and m prime, m prime, I want this matrix to be diagonal. Okay, so my basis here is all of the functions in the lowest Landau level. And now I'm asking whether it's diagonal in this basis. And just aside, if I put here also another Landau level index, then, and I took different Landau levels, then strictly speaking, that would be non-zero, because this is the approximation we made. We assumed that we project everything to the lowest Landau level. So it's exact under this assumption. So let's not look at different Landau levels. Let's just look at the lowest Landau level. And basically, what I need to do is let me drop the center of mass coordinates and just work with relative coordinates. I'm just going to assume that, say, there is no center of mass angular momentum. And I'll call the center of mass coordinate, I'll call it z. And basically, what we'll have is the following, I'll have z to m, and z, sorry, z star to the m, and z to m prime times v of z times e to the minus z squared over 2lb squared. And now, it's easy to see that actually this thing is proportional to a delta function. So this is what I'm going to show. Basically, I can write it in polar coordinates. So this beast is just going to be e to the I m prime minus m theta times r to the m plus m prime, okay? Because the radius kind of adds up in power. This only depends on the radius, and this only depends on the radius. So basically, what I have here is r dr d theta times, yeah, this is not in the exponent, it's just times this. And let me just say, I have f of r here. So this term by itself is enough here, because if I do this angular integration, as long as my interaction only depends on the radius, which we assumed it is, then what I get is something that's proportional to a delta function of m and m prime, which is what we wanted. And if we do it correctly, I just want to say that if you take psi m v psi m and normalize, if your wave functions are not normalized, this is called the Haldane pseudopotential. We're not going to use it, but it gives us a handle on what the interactions actually look like in this basis. But what comes out of calculating the Haldane pseudopotential is the fact that we have bound states. And let me just say a few words on that. Usually, we don't expect to find bound states if we have repulsive interaction. So I can put here the Coulomb interaction. I don't have two types of charges. I only have one type of charge. So I expect the charges to want to repel each other. But actually, in the quantum Hall state, that doesn't happen. And you can think about it in two ways. One is energetics. Two particles would usually want to repel each other because they want to trade their potential energy to kinetic energy. Here, there's no way to gain more or less kinetic energy because all of the states have the same kinetic energy. So it doesn't make sense to fly away. Another way to think about it is semi-classically. So we can think of these m's as orbits. So if our magnetic field is large enough, then our wave functions are really centralized around an orbit because they have, this is the radius Rm. And we can think semi-classically for a minute. So let's just think that we have two of these orbits orbiting in the same direction. The direction is given by the magnetic field. And now we add some interaction between them. Now, if this is the vector that connects their center, then the direction of the force on it is here and here. We have two forces on each one of them. But you might remember what happens to a classical particle in a magnetic field and a perpendicular electric field. You probably did that problem before. So do you know, if I look at this particle circulating, where is it going to go? In which direction? Is it going to follow the force? The field is out of the board. Magnetic field is out of the board. This force, you can think of it as electric field, you know, something like that. So you know that the drift velocity is actually in this direction. I don't know if you've seen that before. Basically, the way to look at it is that you have a circle. Now you add some something that looks like acceleration in that direction. So this part of the motion has a radius that's smaller. The other part of the motion has a radius that's larger, and you end up drifting. So I guess this is the direction. That B, yeah, so the drift velocity is perpendicular to both the magnetic field and the force that's perpendicular to it. And then, so you see that the particles cannot escape because they have a motion that is perpendicular to their distance. So they never increase their distance. And what they do actually is in the end they're going to circulate each other. So, and actually it doesn't matter if it's an attractive force or repulsive force. All that it's going to do, it's going to change the direction of the drift velocity. So if you have particles that are forced to have circular orbits and you let them interact, all they're going to do is bind. And the question is, what is this binding energy, and whether, you know, there's something else that minimizes the energy more. But this is the result for that. Yeah. The distance doesn't change. Because the drift in the end is perpendicular. So they just spiral, the direction is going to change. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive. Okay, so this is all I have to say about stuff that we did yesterday. And let's go on. So I told you that we count one too many. And actually, Laughlin even added three here to make sure that he understands the problem. You'll see one of his seminal papers is actually doing some clever calculations with three particles. But really, you can't do much more than that usually. And plus, I have to say that it's not very useful. You quickly learn that by adding particles one by one, you're not going to get to 10 to the 19 or 20 or whatever. But you might get some intuition by adding one particle to a system with many particles. That sometimes is a good course of action. But anyways, let's first think of the full Landau level in the case of interactions. And very quickly, we'll make it into a fractional Landau level. So for the full Landau level, what Laughlin did, let's call it psi full, the many body wave function of that form, which was pi over I less than j, zi minus zj, e to the minus sum over I, zi squared over 4lb. So basically, Laughlin just wrote down this function. But if you look at it, you can convince yourself that this is the simplest wave function that you can write. So if we want to stay in the lowest Landau level, we know that this is our factor here. And the prefactor actually comes from wanting to populate all of the states. So what do we usually do? So let's say I have a Fermi C. I have many, many states. Let's say I have n states, and I want to put n particles on it. What does the many-body wave function look like? Is it just a product of all of these states? It's a product up to some, up to the fermionic signs, right? So when we did, actually I don't know if you did it in this program, but when you want to describe everything in second quantization, the reason we do that is that we don't want to carry around with us huge Slater determinants. So wave function is usually a Slater determinant. So wave function of many body system would have that kind of form. Let's say I have particles at position z1, and I have n orbitals, then I write the Slater determinant this way. So I'll put the particles here on the columns and the orbitals on the rows. I get here phi n of zn. Okay? Now in our case, all of these phi n's just have a common, just have the prefactor. So we can, in our case, just write here e to the minus zi squared over 4lb squared, because they all come from, in any term in the determinant, I'm going to have this prefactor. And I want to look at the single particle wave functions that we had. So they all had some z to the m times the prefactor. So this we already took care of. So let's put the z to the m's. So I can put z to the 0, z to the 1, z to the 1. And this is going to be z1, z1, 2, z1, n, where n is going to be the lambda level degeneracy, all the way until 1, z, n, and then zn, n. Okay? And this is also called the van der Munde matrix. And if you go ahead and do this, and the way to do it is maybe by recursion relation. You can do it for, you can always think of adding a particle and calculating it this again. You'll find that this is up to an overall minus sign, just this, zi minus zj, I different than j.
Can we use a coherent state instead of using zi minus zj? We use a coherent wave function.
These are not coherent wave functions. When say coherent states, we usually mean that we have some superposition which is an eigenfunction of the creation operator. And this is not what we're doing here. We're just explicitly writing the many-body wave function. So I took all of the orbitals that we had, and I want to put all of my particles on all of the orbitals, so I get a product. But I have to take care of anti-symmetry. And what the Slater determinant does is make sure that I have total anti-symmetry, so that when I exchange particles, I would get a minus sign. So just make sure we have fermions described here. So basically, this is the non-interacting many-body wave function, and it turns out, yeah.
We choose these things just for convenience, right? I mean,
which
you can put any holomorphic function in front of the Gaussian. So.
That's right. Yeah. So we can put whatever we want, but. First of all, it has to be anti-symmetric. And second of all, when I want to describe a full Landau level, I have to choose a basis, and I know that I'm filling all of the states. So for example, if I chose some other functions here, I have to make sure that it really spans the whole space and that they're orthogonal to each other. And that I know, for this basis, I know it. I could choose another basis, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, what's the arrow on the full wing? Are those two things the same? The psi and b?
Ah, okay. So this is a general procedure of how to get a many-body problem, many-body wave function from individual
okay.
orbitals. And this is our private case.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there was another question. Right?
Yeah, is that box formula for the psi b? Is that like the
Yeah, so this is the Laughlin wave function for the full Landau level that he wrote down. And
he kind of guessed that.
He had some intuition. He knew that he wanted to stay in the first Landau level, so he knew that. He knew how it works for the two-body, so he sort of generalized that. And he also knew that what we usually do is take a slated determinant and this is what he did. So actually, he didn't do anything spectacular yet. So when it's full, though, what is still kind of surprising is that this wave function is sometimes exact. So it is exact when I think of the following interaction. So my Hamiltonian is going to be the usual quantum Hall Hamiltonian, and plus V, which would be some V naught, times a delta function of Z I minus Z J, and of course I'm going to have to sum. And this is called hardcore interactions. It means that the particles don't feel each other until they actually lie on the same position exactly. Or a delta function interaction. And if you look at this wave function, you can see right away that this is an eigenstate of our interacting Hamiltonian. And the reason for that is that this potential, if I just look at two particles, this potential is zero until the particles hit each other, right? But this is true for the opposite is true for the wave function. The wave function might be non-zero everywhere, except when two particles are at the same point. So actually, this wave function is extremely suitable for this interaction. If there is no probability for this to ever be non-zero, then the expectation value V on psi full is actually zero. Is that understood why that happens? Okay, so let me say it again. What this tells me, if I want to do this, and I have a delta function here, it tells me that the energy gain from the interaction, so delta of the energy, would be this. Actually, I don't even have to do that. Let's say delta E times pi full is, and now let's just think of two particles, would be V naught times delta Z1 minus Z2. So when the two particles are on each other, I get that, times the wave function Z1 of Z1 minus Z2. Now I need to evaluate this at any given Z1 and Z2. And I have two cases. One case is Z1 not equals to Z2, and the other case is Z1 is equal to Z2. And in both these cases, this energy gain is zero. Because when Z1 is not equal to Z2, the delta function is zero. When Z1 is equal to Z2, our wave function is zero because of this prefactor. This is actually something that also returns when you think of impurities, for example. If you have some, let's say, big impurity somewhere, and you have a wave function that happens to be an eigen wave function that goes to zero on the impurity, you don't feel the impurity. Or if you can accommodate it, if there's some degeneracy and you can arrange for that to happen, then there's no energy gained by the impurity. Otherwise, there would be something. So we found that this non-interacting wave function is actually also the correct wave or the correct ground state for the interacting Hamiltonian of this kind. Yeah.
Is there any problem with the fact that they're complex? They have a modulus inside the delta function, but not a modulus in the wave function?
No, actually, you know that using the complex variables is not very useful here. You can just write everything in R1 and R2, and that's okay. So like I did before when I did the integral. So it's maybe it's only confusing here. It was sort of useful for solving the problem. And you can solve the problem even without it. It just takes a bit more effort to show that you have angular momentum. Yeah, so this is one thing. The other thing that was shown at that time is that actually when you take a different potential, and let's say instead of this potential, I would take a Coulomb potential, something like that, or maybe there's some a dielectric constant actually making that smaller. What some people did is actually take this interaction as say case zero that we understand, and did perturbation theory in the difference between this the two interactions. And it turns out that first of all the perturbation theory works pretty well, but also just numerically, if you just take this wave function and sandwich the interaction, whatever interaction with it, you still find that it's a good ground state for almost any interaction that is physically motivated, like the Coulomb interaction or Yukawa potential or something like that. So it's not a bad approximation for many interactions. And now, so armed with these successes, and also inspired by the fact that the quantum Hall effect was found, the fractional quantum Hall effect was found, Laughlin went on to attack the problem of fractional filling. Where he did something very courageous. So let's say, first of all, let's think of nu equals third. This is the state he had in mind, but actually you can generalize to nu equals 1 over q, where q is odd. So what was seen basically is that when you increase the magnetic field above the quantum limit where all of the electrons are in the lowest Landau level, there's an additional plateau that opens. And the additional plateau opens when the field is such that the filling is third. We saw yesterday that there are many other fractions, but that was the first one that was found. And Laughlin basically said he wanted to do variational calculation. So you know, if you have a problem that you don't know how to solve, you can do many things. One thing is perturbation theory, but it wasn't obvious what is the perturbation that needs to be done here. And the other one is a variational study. So you can guess a function that has some maybe parameters you can play with. You sandwich the Hamiltonian. So let's say if you're interested in the ground state, you take psi of some parameters, let's call them tau, many, many parameters, h psi, and you get the energy that depends on your parameters. For example, this is how we did the mean field, or you did it in John's course. You get this, and now the ground state energy will be E of some special tau, the tau that gives you dE of tau d tau equals to zero. So this is kind of a sketch of a variational study, and this is what Laughlin wanted to do, and he did something like that. He took his favorite wave function for the full Landau level, and he basically added a Q here. So this is all he did. And now let's try to understand what is it that he did. If we had only two particles, what does the Q multiplication here mean? So if when we had two particles, basically our psi 2 looked like z e to the minus z over 2lb squared, where z was the relative coordinate, right? So it looked like the single particle. It looks like the single particle wave function of the relative coordinate, and there was something here of the center of mass, right? But we ignore, let's say we ignore it, then the power of z is the angular momentum between the two, the relative angular momentum between the two particles. Now, if I multiply that by some q here, or sorry, put it to a power q, I'm just increasing the angular momentum by q. Now, if what Laughlin wanted to do would be to take every single particle wave function and add this power q, that would be something like filling up every one in q in q levels. So let me maybe say that again. So I have many, many levels. And this is m equals 1, m equals 2, and so on. And if my wave function is just a product state that I'm populating all of them, then I have a full Landau level. But if I just want to fill one in every q, I can choose my my angular momentum such that it comes in multiples of q. So I'll have q, I'll have 2q, 3q, and so on in my wave function. So maybe this is kind of a motivation to what's going on here. To in every pair, he actually increased the relative angular momentum to be q. But actually, this is not the angular momentum of every pair, because there are many, many, this is a product state, okay? So I have, let's think of the three. One minus three. If you take that to power q, it's actually a big sum, and in every sum, I have a total angular momentum q. So this is what he did. He just multiplied by q. And now let's look at this. Let's look at this and try to understand the properties of this wave function. So I guess there is no standard procedure to follow here. He just wrote the wave function, and now we have to try to understand it. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, and that's true too. That's true here. So I'll show you in a second that Q is related to the filling, and Q has to be odd because here we started with a wave function that is antisymmetric, and if I multiply its Q times, I want it to stay antisymmetric. So it better be odd too. Okay, and what are the properties of the Laughlin wave function at nu equals third? First of all, since it's a many-body wave function, not a prescription that tells us how to multiply single particle wave functions, it already has the filling factor built into it. So you'll do tomorrow with Dennis in the tutorial, you'll do actually a mapping of this wave function onto a classical model. And you'll see that this classical model has some plasma, and basically that's the best way of rigorously showing what I'm going to show next. So I'm going to show, maybe I should write it down, I'm going to show that the properties of the Laughlin wave function are one, that it has 1 over Q filling. So it means that if I ask how many electrons I have in the system, I will have 1 over Q times the degeneracy of the Landau level. 2, it has excitations of fractional charge. And the same excitations also have fractional statistics. Which I'm going to explain in a second. So all of these, I think, are studied in the most elegant and rigorous way through the analogy with the Coulomb gas that you will do tomorrow. For now, let me just address each and every one of these things. So first of all, for the filling, the way I want to look at it is that if I open all of the brackets, I get single particle wave functions, single particle momenta, angular momentum, and the maximum, so I'm just going to get something like Zi, Ni, let's see, Z1, N1, Z2, N2, let's call it M1, M2, and so on. And there are going to be different choices of these M's that I can make to when I open this bracket. Okay, so just many, many terms with the total M being the number of particles times Q. So the largest power that you can get, this M maximum that you can get in the in this is actually Q times N. Actually, it's Q times N minus 1, but let me just forget about this minus 1, say that N is really large, so it doesn't matter so much. So the maximum that I get by opening these brackets is Q times N. But I also know that it cannot be too large. So for a single, sorry, for any single Zi, so if I look at one of them and I ask what is the angular momentum of that particular electron in this part of the superposition, then the maximum is M max. And what I find is that it's Q times N. Okay, just from opening these brackets. Every Z has many, many neighbors, has N minus 1 neighbors, so it appears at least N minus, it appears, could appear up to N minus 1 times in this product, so I get Q times N. And but now we also know that there's a natural maximum to this M, because we did that before when we looked at the orbitals. Each M tells us how many flux quanta we're enclosing. And the total number of, the maximum number of flux quanta that we can enclose is the total flux. So basically, the maximum that we can get is phi naught over phi. Phi over phi naught. Okay, so this is the maximum angular momentum for a single particle in our system, which is also the lambda level degeneracy. So we know that the number of particles we have is the degeneracy of the lambda levels divided by n, by q. So which means that our filling nu is 1 over q. Okay? So this is just by looking at the wave function. Is that clear or not so? Okay. So we know that we have fractional filling. Now we have to ask, I guess another thing we have to ask is, do we have fractional sigma xy?
I think we follow the argument to get the n max equals q.
To get this?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when I open this bracket, okay, now I have many, many, many terms. The highest value, the highest power for any given zi, let's say I just take one of them. For any given zi, the maximum I can get in this product is q times n. Okay, because I have n terms in the product. So I'll get z to the n to the power q. So that's why it's q to the n. But on the other hand, I know that this is also the angular momentum of that wave function, of that single particle wave function, and it has a limit. I cannot give it an angular momentum that encloses more flux than what I have. And the flux that I have is this phi over phi naught. And then it all follows. So now, do we have a fractional sigma xy? And here is where it starts to be less rigorous. What you can do in this problem is very similar to what we did in the original, in the integer quantum Hall effect when we applied the flux threading. So we assumed that we actually closed the sample and threaded a flux. In this gauge, you can also think of just having a sample and in the middle threading an extra flux, which would be the flux quantum. And you can ask what happens with it and calculate how much charge goes from one side to the other. And actually, in the many-body wave function, it's not as simple, because remember that the argument that we used for the integer quantum Hall effect is that we had single particle states. And some were full, some were empty and had some dispersion in the edges and all that. We cannot really use the same thing here. Some people still make that argument saying that maybe this is very similar because of that product, very similar to many body state that is a product state, but it's not actually right. But the way to do it, again, is to do what you're going to do in the tutorial. So I'm going to skip that, and I'm just going to say that when you do that, you find out that you have to introduce Q flux quanta to transfer one electron from the middle to the charge of one electron from the middle to the edge. So if we do the same as before, having I equals delta of the energy over delta phi, then you'll find that the energy would be E times V. That's the energy gain of taking that charge. But here, you'll divide by Q flux quanta, which is H over E. So sigma xy would be 1 over Q times E squared over H. Now, I just want to say that this would also be true if we had, let's say, two plateaus, and in between we'll have some something that extrapolates that we don't have a fractional state. It would be more or less the same thing, because this line in the quantum limit basically just becomes, in the classical limit, just becomes linear dependence. You remember that the sigma xy in the classical limit is just proportional to n, basically. And here we have some intermediate value, so it's going to be more or less that. But if we have a real fractional state and we open up a little gap here, the gap has to be exactly 1 over q times this. Yeah?
A bit of a dumb question. How do you define that filling factor? What's the definition of filling?
Okay. The filling factor is how much, let's say I'm looking at a single lambda level, or the lowest lambda level, but it works for higher, is how much states do I, how much electrons do I have divided by how many states I have. Okay? So, how many states I have, so let me just...
I think that's enough.
That's enough, okay.
Why is it so that it turns out to be 1 over q? Why not like 5 over q or like something like that?
This is exactly here. So these are the number of electrons I have. And I found that times q is equal to dll. Yeah. Okay, so we have fractional sigma xy. We have fractional filling. Now, what are these fractional excitations? Basically, you can think of this flux tube that we added here, the flux that we threaded, as being very small. And you can even move it and put it anywhere. So this is a type of excitation that I can think of. And it turns out that these are the elementary excitations of this wave function. And of course, I'm not, there's some work showing that. Whenever I add this flux, I basically create a hole, because electrons want to mask this charge, or screen this charge. And I get some charge screening here, and the rest is pushed to the perimeter of the disk. And it turns out that if you look at what is the charge, you find a fractional charge. But first, I just want to say, what is the, let's call it Z naught. The position here is Z naught. So let's call it our wave function, our Laughlin wave function, phi nu, plus this flux is actually... the position, take all of the particles we have and do zi minus z naught, meaning that the particles just want to run away from this point that we added, times psi, another way to that we had before. So just to add a flux, all you have to do is multiply by this, and then later in the tutorial, you can actually show that this amounts to a certain charge. And another thing that I want to say about this is that this adds another factor to all of our wave functions. So this effectively increases the angular momentum by 1. You can think of it, if this is some superposition of product states, so in the product, every momentum is going to be multiplied by a factor, by another factor of z, so it will just add some angular momentum. Now, if you look at this wave function and do the same analogy that you did, that you're going to do for this wave function to a Coulomb gas, you'll find that it looks like an additional charge, which means that there's additional charge screening it. And the charge is actually going to be E over 3. But charge doesn't go anywhere. I mean, we didn't add any charge to the system. We just added flux. So the rest is actually pushed here, and you're going to get minus E over 3 on the boundary. Another way that is more straightforward without analogies to calculate this charge would be to just take this new wave function that has the additional flux tube in it and just simply integrate around a region here and get the charge, the charge of the new system, and subtract the charge that we had in the old system without the flux. And that would be the flux addition. And you can see basically that things don't change much when you go away from this region where you inserted the flux. So you actually have a hole that would be localized here, and it will have fractional charge. And let me say a few more things, and then maybe we'll take a little break. So fractional charge is actually, it's interesting, but is by itself maybe not enough to make us that excited. Because if you think of charge as being continuous, maybe there's no reason that even in a simple system we'll have some charge accumulated in some place and in another place, and who said it has to be an integer multiply of the number of electrons. We do have a many-body state, right? It's not just electrons anymore. So collective excitations can have different charges. Usually they are integer multiples of the electron charge. You can think of spinons, for example. They have zero charge, and they have twice the spin of the electron sometimes. So sometimes we have excitations that are not electrons, and maybe it's not that surprising, but this time they have fractional charge. Now the question becomes more interesting is, do they have fractional statistics? And what do I mean by that? I mean that if I have an electron and another electron, we know that we have, or let's say I have a particle, I don't know if it's an electron. The statistics is what I will get when I exchange these particles. And we're talking all the time about these Slater determinants. We want them to be fermions. So fermions mean that I exchange these particles and I get a minus sign. And bosons mean that I exchange them and I don't get any sign. But this actually comes from a deeper understanding of things. So let me assume now that I have my two-dimensional space, x and y, and I have time. And what I want to do is take two particles and exchange their position, like that. And then I want to do it back. And they are identical particles, just like the fermions and the bosons. So I know that if I started from some wave function here, let's call it psi zero, and I got some psi one here, I know that it should be the same wave function up to some phase. Okay, so phases in quantum mechanics are sometimes arbitrary. And even you remember when we did adiabatic changing of our wave function, we sometimes get phases. And there's no reason I shouldn't get a phase here. Let's call it alpha. Now, in three dimensions, this operation of taking two particles, exchanging them twice, is actually always equivalent to the unity. And in two dimensions, it's not. So let me say first why it's not. I have two ways of doing it. One way is I exchange the particle. Let's say I go this way. And then I exchange it again. I can go in the opposite way. So it will be this. So I started from this picture. I end up in this picture. In the snapshot, of course, I don't see the difference. But if you look at my operation, I can smoothly deform it to just be this operation. So this, all of this operator that I acted with on my wave function is equal to unity, or can be smoothly deformed to unity. And actually, in three dimensions, if this wasn't a plane, but it was a three-dimensional place, I could always deform it to unity. So two exchanges are always unity, or we say that they are topologically equivalent to unity. Maybe it's kind of hard to imagine that, but you see, when I talked about it in 2D, I can also think of just going around the other particle. So in 2D, I have two ways of doing, of going somewhere and coming back. I can go like that without enclosing the particle, or I can go like that with enclosing the particles. And these are obviously two different ways of doing things. And I would expect that there could be, doesn't have to be, but there could be a different phase for doing it this way or doing it that way. In three dimensions, now imagine that I have another dimension coming out of the board, I can easily just take this rubber band and put it here, because I have another dimension. In 2D, I cannot do it. So that's why 2D is kind of interesting in a different way here, and has a more rigidness that actually gives me a phase here that doesn't have to be 2 pi. So in the three-dimensional case, alpha has to be 2 pi. So two exchanges have to give me a phase that is an integer number of 2 pi's. And then it means that one exchange gets half of it. So it gets an integer number of pi's of a phase shift. It's going to be an odd number of pi's for a fermion and an even number of pi for a boson. So that's why in three dimensions, we only expect two kinds of particles. On the other hand, in two dimensions, this phase could be anything. And the phase for an exchange is going to have e to the I alpha over 2. And that could be anything. So except for fermions and boson, we have anyons, because they can have any kind of statistics. And in the quantum Hall state, I think it's the first example of anyons. Examples of anyons that not only do they have fractional charge, E over some Q, they will also have fractional statistics. So if you will take two of these little things and exchange their position, or even just take one around the other, you will get a phase e to the 2 pi I over q. So this operation will be associated with e to the 2 pi I over q. So this means that these objects are not fermions or bosons, they're anyons. And to see this, we're not going to do it today, but what I think at 83, Dana Rovas and company, what they did is exactly that. They basically took this wave function, multiply it by that factor. So they took psi q plus z naught. So they had psi q times pi z I minus z naught. So they put a little flux tube on z naught. And then they moved, they put two of them and moved z naught of one of them around the other one. And basically, you can do that because you have the full wave function. So you can just calculate what is the phase that is accumulated. You start with a full wave function, so there, let's say there's another one, zi minus w naught. You have two of these objects. All you have to do is slowly move one coordinate around the other and calculate the accumulated phase. And this is what they did. It's not trivial, but it's doable. And they found a phase that is fractional. So let's take a little break here and come back and talk about the fractional quantum Hall effect from a different angle.